You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we're hosting an Occupy 5th Anniversary special, bringing on guests Lee Camp of Redacted Tonight, Jerry Ashton of Rolling Jubilee and RIP Medical Debt, and Sue Sierra Lupe of Occupy Medical to discuss what has happened because of Occupy. Joining us for this conversation is Occupy Radio co-host David Getchy Sierra Lupe.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguanu, welcome. I'm coming to you here from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawabskek territory, located in and along the shores of the beautiful and mighty Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my radiant co-host, Mr. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. We have a special treat for the listeners today. We've brought David Getchy Sierra Lupe, who was my co-host back in Occupy Radio days, onto the show for a special series of interviews on the Occupy movement. We're coming up on September 17th, which is the anniversary of the Occupy protests that launched in Zuccotti Park in New York City. And we're going to interview a series of guests on what has happened because of Occupy. That's the theme of the 5th anniversary gathering that's going to be happening on September 17th. And it's also a very intriguing conversation to open up all these years later. Welcome to the show, Getch.
Hey there. It's good to be back.
It's wonderful to be sharing the airwaves again with you. And
yes, it is.
And we also have a special guest on the line to kick off today's show, Lee Camp, the host of Redacted Tonight. He's a name that many of us recognize out here in the alternative circles and those of us who have a sense of humor. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Lee, I want to thank you for joining us on the show. And this is a special thing for me because this is the first time I've been on the air in 8 months. And the first chance I've had to speak with you in 3 years, Lee. We spoke last on 2013 in June on Occupy Radio.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It has. And Occupy has seemed to diminish quite a bit in the meantime. But you, on the other hand, have not. So maybe we could talk, for starters, Rivera was saying that one of the themes is, how has Occupy changed your life? Is that what it is, Rivera?
What has changed because of Occupy? Because of Occupy is the catchphrase they're using. And I know in our own lives, we'll talk about this a little later in the show, we've had a lot of shifts and changes and movements into action and new projects that have come about because of it. So, Lee, what's happened in your life because of Occupy?
Well, yeah, you mentioned that, Occupy maybe as a concept is kind of diminished, but I haven't. But I think that's true of a lot of alternative media, alternative activists, and a lot of people that became activated or at least saw a bump in energy and a bump in forum from Occupy. So I think that it did spawn a lot of the personalities we see on various forms of alternative journalism, and I'm doing this TV show Redacted Tonight, and it seems to have gotten a lot of traction. And, you know, I think it speaks to the fact that occupying was a technique, it was a protest technique, and no protest technique lasts forever. Governments and the powers that be always find ways to undermine a new technique. So protesting in general and protesting against this insane income inequality, this exploitation of all of our resources in our world, needs to always be changing. The protest against it needs to be growing and shifting and moving. And so I think that's why you see the term Occupy maybe diminishing in terms of its brand power, but I think what it created in a lot of us and a lot of the conversation in this country and in the world continues on like ripples growing maybe ever larger across an ocean.
Your message was already pretty distinct before Occupy started, Lee, but do you feel like your message was occupied, so to speak?
I mean, yeah, I was saying those things before Occupy, and in fact, I was asked to make a video encouraging Occupy and encouraging moving your money out of the big banks before Occupy started. So obviously I was doing that and a little bit of a name before that. So, you know, I feel like every few years, and I think you're going to see it more and more, what I've been saying and what a lot of people have been saying about living in an unsustainable way, both economically and environmentally, every few years it hits the kind of mainstream media cycle or whatever, it becomes mainstream. And that's what happened in Occupy. What I was saying dovetailed with what the nation finally cared about. And then it faded a little. And then we saw it again, I feel like, with Bernie Sanders' campaign. And it all came rushing back and people cared again. And you know, I talked a lot about election fraud and how the primaries were stolen from Bernie. But so, yes, I have kind of gained some traction with Redacted Tonight and with stuff I do. But I think it's because the nation's attention is on the same issues that I keep talking about, even when they're not the mainstream issues.
Do you think that core issue that you've been addressing and that Occupy tried to address has been advanced in this country, or do we just more aware of it, the issue of inequality and the corruption of the political and corporate and Wall Street collusion to manipulate financial markets to increase the wealth of the 1%. Do you think that there has been any advance made on that particular issue outside of this notable increase of awareness that has happened?
Well, I think awareness is an advance in the issue. And I think what we're seeing now is the establishment, the oligarchy, you know, the rule by an elite rich few. We're seeing their kind of, in my opinion, last grasp at holding on to a completely unsustainable system. And we're seeing it in the increase in the surveillance infrastructure, the police state. You know, we're seeing it in a kind of lockdown of the media. Journalists like Amy Goodman, you know, she has an arrest warrant out for her for covering the North Dakota protests. And you see a crackdown on media, but I think that or alternative media, but I think that kind of thing is a last grasp at trying to keep this system moving along in the same way it always has. And in fact, I think it's crumbling. You know, the belief in the media or trust in our mainstream media is at the lowest it's ever been. And trust of our presidential candidates is at the lowest it's ever been. Dislike of our presidential candidates is at the highest it's ever been. And Congress's approval rating is at 11% or something, one of the lowest it's ever been. So all of these things have to do with people becoming more informed, realizing we're looking at a rigged system, seeing how the media manufactures consent for war and for income inequality. And I think all of those things are an advance towards changing things, towards a grand change.
Ned, do you feel like, depending on where the puppet show goes in November, if we get the really fascist puppet or the really neoliberal puppet, do you think either way, after it's all done and after we're all forced to accept the fact that we didn't get what we wanted no matter how we voted, do we have fertile ground for, I don't want to call it Occupy 2 because I think you're right, it was just a tactic, but the next uprising, do you feel like no matter where we go in November, the next uprising is inevitable?
Yeah, and it's tough to say what form that'll take, but we are, both Hillary and Trump represent the continued corporate totalitarianism of our government, and I think that, yeah, it will make fertile ground for people to continue to stand up and protest against this and stop things like the Dakota Pipeline that is trying to slice its way through America right now. And I do think the time will be ripe. I mean, the time is still ripe right now because people know that whatever they get in November, it's not going to be good. I've heard some interesting things about you know, when you have faux liberal in the White House, as I think Obama's been, it tends to cut the protest against the furthering of the corporate domination, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It tends to cut that protest in half because enough people look at Obama and say, well, he wants it, so it must be the liberal thing. It must be the progressive thing to want the TPP. You know, you get someone like a right winger in office, and now that protest is solidified against corporate rule. So I don't know what's going to happen, but either way, it'll be, like you said, fertile ground.
The question that I'd like to ask, Lee, is how do you feel the movements that have emerged since Occupy can benefit from some of the gaps that existed within the Occupy movement? There were a number of areas where people felt that the organizing could have been a bit tighter and that the momentum that was created wasn't really used effectively going forward. Do you think that we've learned anything from that? And have you seen any evidence of that in the movements that you've been following?
Well, I think I do see maybe a lot more people talking about how things get changed democratically and bureaucratically. There seems to be more awareness of that. And I think that's important, too. You know, that's not what I do. I don't sit down and write laws, but I understand that that's important to have people, you know, writing laws, people deciding how many votes need to be obtained in state legislatures to get things approved. And you see that on the right wing. That's why ALEC has been so successful. If it just goes up at lawmakers' doorsteps, says, here's the bill and here's how many votes we need. And it makes it easy for these lawmakers to force these things through. So I think the progressive side needs to get better at that. And I think we are seeing that to some extent. And then in another way, I think occupying as a protest form, I think it definitely taught people a lot about how to succeed as a protest. And, you know, you need to understand that a certain number of people down at any protest are going to be playing close cops and things like that. And you need to have a game plan for succeeding even with that. And I think we're seeing it work pretty well at Standing Rock. I mean, as best it can when you are average people up against the largest corporate monolith that could ever exist. So it's a massive battle, but I think you do see how successful some of this protest can be.
One of the things that I certainly have come to believe as an indigenous rights attorney, and I know that many of my colleagues within the field of law feel the same way, that it may not be effective to attempt to make changes in the laws and to take legal action as really one of the primary means of impacting the movement forward of these monoliths, as you call them. They're so big and they're so deeply entrenched within our political system and our legal system, and our system of laws has been designed to protect them. And so do you think that it's going to be the movement of people, citizens outside of that system, that are going to actually effectuate change? And how do they do that? I mean, my idea is that we start creating a new system outside of this system, one that actually may work for people. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, I think you're right that the criminal justice system, the justice system, has basically been bought off by the corporations. And if you are able to afford the most expensive lawyers, you will generally win. And we see them, I think, overplaying their hand and putting out arrest warrants for Jill Stein and Amy Goodman in Standing Rock. And what it's doing, you know, for quote-unquote trespassing. And people go, well, how is it that is someone reporting on it as trespassing, but the bulldozers bulldozing the land aren't trespassing? And what it does is, I think it does create what we really need, which is a revolution of the mind. People need to start viewing things differently and realizing that, hey, some of these laws don't seem legal. They don't, like, the laws don't fit with the way I'd like to see a society work. And why does this corporation get to send in attack dogs so that they can bulldoze my land, and yet I spray paint the bulldozer and I'm the one arrested? And I think it, when the system stops serving the people, if they get angry enough, it does start to change. And so I think it needs to be that shift in mental state. It needs to be a revolution of the mind. And then there was the second half of your question, which I now forget.
The second half of the question was related to the people, you know, we the people, we have an obligation to stand up against unjust laws that have been developed to support this structure of oligarchy. And what should we be doing in order to create new systems alongside of and outside of this system in order to change the status quo?
Right. And people are doing this. You can see it in pockets here and there in a lot of different ways. Some of them are viewed as legal and fine. You know, something as small as, let's say, a tool share or a ride share or things like that, so that we are not wasting immense numbers of resources. We're starting to realize that living in a society where everyone buys a, you know, $200-$300 drill and leaves it in their shed and never uses it but once every 5 years is not a sustainable way to live. So you could have a tool share in a neighborhood and people, you know, have a drill that's used all the time or a saw that's used all the time, but it's used by different people. And we're starting to realize there are different ways to live. Now, some of them are, you know, the establishment is fine with them and they will start growing that way, which I think you're seeing. And then sometimes the established laws try and stop that type of thing. So a lot of the communal living areas, places that are off the grid, have been raided by police. And, you know, because you're legally obligated to be hooked into the electrical grid because you're not allowed to be off the grid. And there's things like that where it seems like it's the status quo trying to, you know, using police to try and enforce living the same way we've always lived. But I think that once you get that mental shift that I was talking about earlier, you see people shifting the way they live. And you're right. We need to start building the society we want to see and so that that can grow. And really the whole idea of states and cities is that they can try things and you find out what works best and you find out who's living in the best way and who has the least pollution, and you then adopt those things. But instead, a lot of cities where they, you know, are able to achieve it, one city's gotten to, you know, almost completely sustainable clean energy, and then other cities are fighting to keep theirs dirty, you know, fighting to stop banning on fracking. But in fact, we should be adopting the best practices that we see throughout the country.
So I want to bring us back to politics, Lee. I know that'll be unfamiliar territory. Rivera and I covered the oligarchy study a couple years back, which basically said, kind of proved that we don't have representation for our votes. And one of the critiques of the Occupy movement is that we didn't do like the Tea Party and we didn't occupy the left wing of the Democratic Party. What's your feeling about that? Is that a meaningful goal to try to affect change currently through the political structure when it's been kind of shown that that avenue is somewhat shut off from us?
Yes, I think it needs to happen at all levels. So it needs to be protest that is not just around, or energy that is not just around getting votes and getting certain politicians in. But then I think that energy towards getting various kinds of politician into office can be important if we can really start to shift it in a larger way. One of the things I've been trying to put forward, and, you know, various people have had different ideas similar to this, is the idea of certifying candidates as clean money candidates. And there aren't that many out there. Bernie Sanders is one of them who refused to take corporate money and super PAC money. There are some, though, like Zephyr Teachout and Jill Stein and some others. But the idea, which we just created the organization and the website recently, I think it's cleanmoneycandidates.org, and it's very much in beta. We're just getting it off the ground. But the idea would be that we could certify candidates as clean money candidates, and then people could look up their area, find out which candidates, both local and federal, in their area refuse to take corporate and super PAC money. And then you could slowly really start to shift our government towards mostly clean money candidates, and candidates that are then able to go on a debate stage and say, hey, I've been certified clean money candidate, this other guy is not. And hopefully that starts meaning something to people. But I do completely understand that as our government stands right now, it is the business interests that will win 98% of the time, and we can't go on like that.
Well, Lee, it seems to me that there's been a lot of work done and a lot of work left to do, and or maybe even more work left to do than the days of Occupy. But it certainly has influenced the very conversation that we're sitting on the air having today with people all across the country listening in, that this conversation would have taken a different shape and tone and texture had it not been because of Occupy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio and sharing your thoughts. We very much appreciate you and the work that you do. Can you give a shout out for Redacted Tonight and where people can connect with that and the work that you're doing?
Yes, the show is called Redacted Tonight, and even though I wasn't very funny here, it is a comedy show and usually makes people laugh pretty good. If people want to check it out, it comes out every week on RT America, but it's also all on YouTube, so people can check out an episode right now if they want at youtube.com/redactedtonight. And leecamp.net is where my blog and the videos and everything else is. Oh, and I have shows coming up in Denver and Washington, D.C. If people want info on that, they can get it at leecamp.net.
Thank you, Lee, for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we have another opportunity to talk with you in the future.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Next up on Love and Revolution Radio today for our Occupy Wall Street 5th anniversary special is a fellow named Jerry Ashton, who was involved with Rolling Jubilee, which many of us will remember from the Occupy days, and he'll catch us up to date with some of the accomplishments of Rolling Jubilee. But he'll also share one of the projects that came about because of Occupy, that he's the executive vice president and co-founder of Rest in Peace, RIP Medical Debt. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
I'm very pleased to be on. Thank you.
Hi, Jerry. This organization, Rest in Peace Medical Debt, is dealing with a really horrific crisis that is facing a lot of people in this country, and certainly is something that many people can relate to. Can you tell our listeners about the project or the program and what it offers to people?
Sure. And by way of background, since the Rolling Jubilee of Occupy Wall Street was the touchstone for what we were doing, and this is what gave us the motivation to start RIP Medical Debt, and that is a decision made back in 2012 by a working group called Strike Debt, which created a second work group called Rolling Jubilee. And the idea behind Rolling Jubilee was to, at that time, in their thinking, was to go out and raise $50,000 and then abolish $1 million worth of medical debt. Totally outrageous idea. It had never been done before. And I was in Occupy Wall Street, and I was aware of what they were doing, and I admired the progress that they went through in creating a 501c4, which is a nonprofit that doesn't allow people to deduct their donations, but it does allow the 501c4 to be a lobbying machine, and the lobbying that they were doing was anti-debt, and in particular, anti-medical debt. So that's the start. What else would you like to know?
I would like to know about your history as a former debt collector and what you brought from that experience into this project.
That is a bit unusual, isn't it? It's almost like, what happened here? Maybe on the way to Damascus, I was struck down and woke up and decided I didn't want to be a tax collector anymore. In my case, I was a bill collector, and I still do that work. You have to bring in money when sometimes if it doesn't come in another direction for charities. But as a bill collector, I'd worked in the medical industry as well, and it was, you know, probably the most difficult debt to deal with as a collector. Dealing with someone's mental, physical, and emotional pain, and also asking them to pay what is owed the doctor wasn't the easiest of collections. So as a bill collector, that was my job. I had it for years. Along came the Rolling Jubilee, and along came Occupy, which put the entire subject of debt to question. How can a civilized society allow its members to go bankrupt or go into debt because of a medical bill or medical crisis. So visiting Zuccotti Park, and just first as a visitor and then as someone who began chronicling it and taking pictures and joining working groups, I got educated to the idea that, not that I didn't already know it, that some debt is suspect and some debt shouldn't even exist at all. So when the Rolling Jubilee successfully put together their campaign to abolish this debt, this target of theirs, they actually succeeded far beyond their wildest dreams. Instead of bringing in $50,000 in donations, they brought in something like $700,000. And in the course of events, they abolished about $35 million worth of debt, most of it medical, but they also branched out into educational loans as well as payday debt, things like that. So if you're asking about how I positioned myself as a bill collector, it's very simple. I took every tool that I had and every knowledge that I had and every technology that I had and got information when we created this 501c3. I'll explain the difference in a minute. When we were designated a charity, my job then was to go out and find that debt, buy that debt, but then, much like Rolling Jubilee, I forgave it. The RIP medical debt had the ability to forgive medical debt with no tax consequences to the recipient. So I guess I'm a reformed bill collector.
That's an amazing story, Jerry, and it's really apropos to the subject that we like to talk about a lot on Love and Revolution Radio, which is that of nonviolent struggle. One of the strategic principles that we speak about a lot is this idea that there are many pillars of support holding a problem in place, things like materials or human resources or the security forces of a state or a private entity, things that really hold the problem where it is in its empowered position. And the goal of a movement mm-hmm. is actually to remove those pillars of support, but even more than remove them, to transform them into something that's supporting the solution in the world. Now, one of those pillars that's been identified by the scholar Gene Sharp is skills and knowledge. And I always have trouble in my nonviolent workshops explaining this one so clearly to people, but your story is a really clear example of it. You once were using your skills and knowledge to support the very problem that was causing, or part of the problem that was causing suffering in our world. You encountered a movement, or a series of protests, the Occupy protests. You encountered their knowledge, and you changed your position, withdrawing your consent and cooperation from the problem, and instead putting it into the solution, which was Rolling Jubilee and Rest in Peace Medical Debt. I think that's truly remarkable and a real powerful story and testimony to what happens when we organize. It's a very unusual story in many ways, but a very important one for people to understand. I want to ask you, was it difficult with your colleagues or your coworkers, and what was the journey of maybe opening some of these conversations with them? Was it a challenge to start to shift in this way?
Yes, it was a challenge. In my industry, I'd always been a gadfly. I always pointed out things that needed to be changed, and I wrote a blog for the Inside Arm, which is a website for bill collectors. And I would be contrarian, and I would bring up things that needed to be changed. But when I started blogging about Occupy and about the Rolling Jubilee, and then when the Rolling Jubilee rolled out what they were doing, people in my industry practically freaked out. First of all, they thought it was insane. Secondly, they looked at people that were trying to do something like this as suckers. You know, let's sell them some really, really bad debt, because they didn't realize that bad debt is what exactly both RIP Medical Debt and Once Upon a Time the Rolling Jubilee wanted to buy.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and a special song from Diane Patterson, Shall We Rise, Occupy, from her Build a Bridge CD.
The pieces of shall we?
now let's return to our program.
What they consider to be a waste of time of chasing people down for money because they couldn't pay it, really looked at being the opportunity to be able to relieve people of that debt. And in our case, we're actually able to get it off of credit reports. So to bring you up to date with where this transition and transformation has come, Craig Antico is my partner in this, and he is also a longtime credit and collections and a specialist in debt buying. And he and I put RIP medical debt together. And when we started doing what we were doing, we went out to the debt industry and they knew us and they said, this is what we're doing. And we're not doing it as activists so much. We're not doing it as protesters so much. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And we think you should be helping us. And interestingly enough, the debt buyers were very open to selling us debt, realizing that if they sold us the debt, they wouldn't be able to sell it to a bill collector. And the reason they would sell it to us is because we gave them a promise that when we got that debt, we weren't going to chase it down for money. We were going to abolish it. So in a way, it was a good feeling for people in that industry to be able to contribute to good efforts. And even though it was taking money away from other people in the industry. Does that make sense to you?
Makes sense to me. I want to follow up with that because okay. You're talking about how it makes people feel good about relieving that debt, and it's a feeling I'm sure isn't an ordinary feeling in that industry. And the industry itself, the debt industry, it seems to me, is a direct product of neoliberal politics, which, you know, if we circle back to Occupy in a lot of ways is a direct result of neoliberal politics. And the growth of debt that is involved in all that, it seems to me that it's, you know, it's the underpinning of so much of our economy, especially to keep throwing the word neoliberal out, the neoliberal economy. The fact that it's so rooted in debt seems to indicate to me that it's not actually a system that's designed to meet the needs of the people. And so your efforts in RIP Medical Debt and the Rolling Jubilee are efforts at reform. So do you feel like
they are that?
Well, I guess number one, can you talk a little bit about just the value of debt, or is there value in debt?
Okay. First of all, debt existed long before neoliberals came along. Bill collectors have been chasing money down through history. And this industry exists only because debt, of course, is created, and it's debt that other people are not able to recover. So without necessarily making the debt collector a bad guy, because many times someone who has to meet payroll, someone who has to pay his own bills, is owed money by somebody, they don't pay. They're not equipped to be able to get that money, so they bring in a third party, such as a debt collector or a collection agency, to do that work for them. When that money is recovered, that money goes back into the business and into the industry. So we're taking a look at the fact that there's good debt and there's bad debt. When you and I go out and buy that car in order to be able to get ourselves to work, that's called good debt. When we go out and have a heart attack, I call that bad debt, and the bad in the sense that it shouldn't even exist. And my job, my campaign, along with Craig Antico, is that we're going to make such an impact in our industry that we intend to go out and buy and abolish $1 billion worth of medical debt. And that isn't that difficult to do, because remember, in the debt industry, this is sold back and forth for pennies on the dollar. So it could be possible that for only $14 million, I can go out and buy $1 billion of the medical debt and abolish it. That's called a good thing.
I want to follow up with the softball on that one, though.
Okay.
So as a result of the neoliberal politics and all the swelling of debt, does it meet a social purpose, or have we come to the point where it's culturally speaking, it's just harming us, and it's an indication that we have a system right now that isn't designed to meet the needs of the many, only the needs of the few?
I'll support that thought. Debt in and of itself is not a good thing. And the way that debt is perpetrated on people is not a good thing. So you and I could easily say that if we were to be hardball about this, we could say that debt is created to keep people enslaved so that they have to do their 9-to-5 jobs. They don't have enough money left to be able to do anything like protest. And I can say that on behalf of many of my fellow protesters. Many of us have had to, you know, we haven't had two nickels to rub together, and we're still out there in the streets. We're still out there writing blogs. We're still out there singing songs. We're still out there doing what we need to do to wake up the rest of the world. But debt, no, I don't think that debt is a good thing.
I think that the model that you're creating is really important, because we know that those who have the highest amount of debt are often those with the least means, because those who have greater means are able to leverage those means in order to avoid getting into incredible amounts of debt. And right. And so do you think that this is transferable? Because we have an incredible problem with student loan debt. I was a single mother getting through my education, both my undergrad and law school, and struggled to be able to survive. And as a result, even though I had academic scholarships, still have an incredible amount of student loan debt that I accumulated just for being able to support my family while I was going to school. And so do you think that a program like this could be transferable into other areas where there's an incredible amount of debt?
First people I ran into in Occupy were students in debt, and they would come up and ask me and talk to me about their debt and what to do about it. So I'm incensed by student debt, and I'm incensed by the banks that make all the money off of it. I'm incensed by Wall Street that supports it. I'm not a fan of for-profit colleges. I'm certainly not a fan of the colleges that, frankly, charge too much. They pay their administrators and their president very, very well. The faculty, if they're lucky, to be paid at associate wages. And then, of course, the poor student is loaded up with $20,000-$30,000 a year. That is insane. That is insane. So the strike debt people broadened their work and created something called the Debt Collective. So if you go to thedebtcollective.org, you'll see what they've done in chasing after student debt. They've done a magnificent job.
Great. Well, I'm sure we could have you back on to go deeper into that subject, but we are headed in towards the last few minutes that we have together today on our Occupy anniversary special on Love and Revolution Radio. Jerry, I'd like to ask you just to share some personal thoughts of what in your heart has changed because of Occupy. Just one last thought as we're heading out of our time together today.
I would say that everything's changed. Occupy was just as important on September 17th as the 11th of September was prior to that. This is a ground-shaking event that happened there. And there are so many books that are put out on Occupy, what it created. Every movement, everything that's going right now, if it isn't actually staffed by former occupiers, it's invigorated or infused by the same spirit that was there at Zuccotti Park so many years ago, 5 years ago, this coming Saturday, September 17th.
Jerry, thank you for joining us on the show today. And we would love to get into this conversation with you more deeply at some point in the future.
It would be my pleasure.
Occupy.
Spinning off the heels of that great interview with Jerry Ashton on Rest in Peace Medical Debt, we have another angle on the medical story and how the Occupy movement ignited a very particular intervention into our broken healthcare system. We're going to speak with Sue Sierra Lupe, who is the founder and clinic manager of Occupy Medical, which is in Eugene, Oregon. She is the author of 10 books, which you can find along with some of her other work and writings on thepracticalherbalist.com. And there you can also listen in to some of her podcasts from Real Herbalism Radio. She's a really incredible person, and we'll let Getch, her husband, kick off with the first question.
All right. Well, so you know, Rivera, one of the themes here is how has Occupy changed your life, our lives, and everything? And I can definitely say that Occupy has had a big change in my life in that before Occupy started, I had a full-time wife. But we do pass each other every now and then when Sue is going from medical clinic to City Hall speaking engagement to, I don't know, Portland, where I think you're right now discussing delivering health to the unhoused. So
in Portland, I'm giving a workshop on public health.
Okay, well, there you go. So, yeah, that's one of the changes.
He doesn't even know what I'm doing here. There you go.
So, anyways, that's my own personal whininess about the impacts of Occupy. And so, Sue, you had many chances on Occupy Radio and in on Chaos Theory Radio to regale our listeners with tales of Occupy Medical. But why don't you give the new listeners of Love and Revolution Radio the Occupy Medical tour, a verbal tour?
Okay. All right. Well, Occupy Medical started as a first aid tent in October of 2011, and we started seeing people. At this time, it was before the ACA, which is also called Obamacare. We were seeing people that we weren't seeing in clinics or in hospitals in which many of us worked. And the kind of issues that we were seeing were fairly gruesome. And we could not shut that off. And we knew that folks, when they were packing up, because the cops shut down the Occupy encampment, I believe it was December 22nd. It was a couple days before Christmas. Then those people were just going to go back to the shadows without care, and we couldn't live with that. So we tried by just doing a little bit of first aid stuff during the week, but it didn't quite work out, and it became abundantly clear that we needed a clinic. So I proposed that we start a weekly clinic, and we bring back our doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals and just serve people with the demonstration that healthcare is a human right, and single payer, universal health care needs to be the path that we pick as Americans, or at least as Oregonians, because that saves lives and it saves money. It's win-win. Even for corporations, they will save lives and they will save money. And there's no reason why, except for the pressure from insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, why we shouldn't have it. So we just have to show people what it looks like when healthcare is a human right, and people will make a place in their mind to change their mind about what universal healthcare looks like if they actually see it as a process, as a demonstration. And we have been doing that for 5 years, and we went from people driving by us, flipping us the bird, or recommending that we go get a job, which is kind of tough to figure out how I would fit another job into my already 3 job listings, but I did not take their advice. I just continued doing what I knew to be the correct course and was joined by more and more healthcare professionals. We started with, there were 7 or 8 of us. There are now about 50, and we still give free medical care every Sunday at the park blocks. And we also were an integrated health clinic, so we also give herbs, which, as you may be aware, your listeners may be aware, with the opioid-based medication snafu that we're having, with people dying from their addiction issues or just being financially imprisoned by these medications, to be able to offer people a non-addictive, side effect-free herbal medicine, not marijuana, no scheduled meds, but, you know, things like St. John's wort or wild lettuce, et cetera, to have that option for folks makes people safer and it makes them healthier and it's economically feasible. So we've been doing that for approximately 5 years. It will be 5 years coming up here at the middle of October. And we also, right now, we're serving between 40 to 60 patients every week. And we serve food and hygiene supplies to between 200 to 300 visitors a week, too, during that 4-hour clinic period.
Sue, so one of the things that strikes me about this is the fact that you say that this is a human right, that whole notion that the access to medical treatment when needed is a human right has been so skewered by the structure of our medical industry. And I'm wondering, as a healthcare professional, your experience and that of others who are participating in this really important work, what are you recognizing within yourself in regard to difference in the way that you're able to give care within your Occupy medical clinics and the way that you're required to give care within some of these healthcare facilities? Because it's a completely different model based on the fact that you're treating people like human beings who have a right to be well.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes. And that's a really great question, which is one that we end up discussing every single week. I do work in a clinic, which is a low-cost clinic during the week. That's kind of my bread and butter. And then on Sundays, I'm providing free care under the single-payer model. For doctors, what some people do not realize, between 30 to 35% of a doctor's on-the-clock time is wrangling with insurance companies. Now, under the single-payer model, that minimalizes between 10 to 15%, averaging at 12%. So that's what other countries are showing us. That's a lot more bang for the buck. Now, when you consider, particularly in the state of Oregon, where doctors tend to be a little more low paid, doctors are getting like $80 to $100 an hour. When you're using that time, and this is with supplemental care from other medical professionals, people that their job is just to do billing, still, considering the fact that they have staff specifically for billing, that's still what doctors are doing. They are trying to pirate care for their patients. For us, we don't have to pirate care. We just decide, this is a conversation that I've just had with this patient. This patient feels comfortable with this, and I can get this for them, and I don't have to ask anyone else permission. The permission comes from what the patient is comfortable with and what resources we have. The end. That's how it becomes. We use the term integrated healthcare. We use the term patient-centered care. That's how it becomes patient-centered. And that honors people's right to live, people's right to make choices, and it improves people's sense of, this is my body. This is my life. It is my responsibility to take care of myself. And the kind of improvements we see in people's lives with that model of care, as opposed to one that's run by insurance companies, is astronomical. It's out of control different. When people feel that they are, in fact, responsible for their own lives, then you've got the real human life coming. Then you've got people that just feel like, oh my gosh, I can take custody of the choices that I make, and they make much better choices. When people do not feel that they have to make choices out of despair, that they have two cards to choose from, and neither of them look good, you see huge, much more healthy life changes. That's the human right.
Sue, will you speak a little bit about who your patients are each Sunday in Occupy Medical? Because as I understand it, one of the important things that you're doing is providing healthcare coverage to people who cannot afford healthcare. But you once told me in another interview that that's not exclusively the work that you do, that sometimes you're treating patients who actually have healthcare coverage but can't get an appointment with their doctor. So can you describe to our listeners who comes on Sundays, who might show up?
Okay, it's really changed a lot since, like I said, Obamacare has kicked in. Before, it seemed like we were primarily dealing with people that were unhoused and they had no health care. Now, you know, in Oregon, we do have OHP, which is in our county, is run by Trillium Centene, is the new owner of that one. And those folks, you know, people that make under $16,000 a year, this population is eligible for OHP. The people that are working class that make over $16,000 a year, but under a certain amount, you know, $500 a month as a monthly bill, add that onto child care or rent or, you know, let's talk really luxurious stuff like food, clothing. You know, those items, just if you have to choose between paying for healthcare and feeding your kids, which some of these folks do, you're just going to have to go for food. So we have approximately 40 to 50%, it really depends on the week and the season, of folks that come to us. They have jobs, they have homes, but they do not have access to health care. And some of the folks that have health care, they're coming to us because they, you know, one of the things about being in an insurance company is you get to make huge choices about who you allow into the healthcare model. So for an insurance company, for example, they will say to themselves, and I'm using our county as the perfect example, they say, you know, I'm going to approve this small amount of practitioners. Those are the people that will be eligible for granting OHP in medicine to folks. And if people, all these other people that have OHP, they're paying their bill no matter what. We're getting it either from them or from the government. We get the check. They are working really hard in order to sign even more people up for OHP, but they are not working hard in order to sign up more practitioners. If people don't get to go to a doctor, that makes it even more profitable for those insurance companies. They've still got a huge money stream coming in, but they funnel it by limiting the amount of practitioners and the amount of visits that the people that are qualified for OHP can go to. So it's for them to provide crappy medicine, for them to have just a tiny little list of folks that can go to mental health services, which they are promising, that's a guaranteed moneymaker. And in our county, Trillium, for example, they just sold the company. This is supposed to be a nonprofit insurance OHP company, Trillium. These folks made $34 million. That was their profit margin, just the profit margin. It was split between, you know, a handful of shareholders, one of them a former mayor. Now, I feel like as the person that wrote the check for that insurance, personally, I should have just written the check and brought it to former Mayor Tory and said, hey, here's the check. Instead of writing it to OHP, which, of course, I had to fight and battle in order to get an appointment, I should have just given it to you. That way I could see what you're spending the money on. Where's the new car you're buying with my money? I just want to see it so I can at least see a little smile on your face. I have a little satisfaction. It's going to something that's making somebody happy. Because for me, my one appointment that entire year that I spent money for insurance, that was one appointment. And I spent a year's worth of money, monthly checks, for one single appointment that lasted 15 minutes. No wonder insurance companies want to keep the single-payer universal health care system out of America.
I think we can safely say, as we're closing our show on the anniversary of Occupy, that because of Occupy, lives are being saved. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous to blame this all on Occupy without giving a huge hat tip and a deep bow of gratitude to yourself and to your fellow practitioners who decided that it just wasn't acceptable to just leave people in the strait they were in as Occupy encampments were shut down. So thank you for this incredible service that you're doing and continue to do with Occupy Medical.
It's our pleasure, and it really is an honor to serve. People can look at our website, occupy-medical.org, and see our protocols listed up there so that they can duplicate the service that we have been offering in their own community. Thanks for giving us a chance to talk about the exciting work that we are doing at Occupy Medical.
Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, Sue.
Some say the commons have been privatized and the banks own it all. But this is bigger than it looks, and tyranny's bound to fall.
So, Gitch, I'm a little curious, as we're asking all of our guests, because of Occupy, what's shifted or changed, or what kind of new perspective or different perspective might you have on the world? What's up for you? What are you thinking about in this?
Well, you know, I did mention the fact that Occupy, you know, removed my wife from my life to some degree for Occupy Medical. And then another thing it did was I am now part of a community of activists, and I am a much more skilled representative of the media as a result of Occupy.
And we're friends, too, as a result of Occupy.
There you go.
That's a real good streak for that movement.
Yeah. Thank you, Occupy, for bringing you, Rivera, into my life.
Right. Sherry, what about you?
Well, it's been interesting to look at this and to think about what I can attribute within my own realm of experience to Occupy. And one of the things that I think that correlates here is the fact that we have become visible to one another in a way that we weren't before. We were all kind of siloed in our own individual little issues. And certainly Indigenous peoples were largely ignored by the larger population. And Indigenous rights issues were overlooked. And now, because people have become aware and awake and are seeing the impacts of these things rolling out into their own communities, because of the visibility that kind of rose up with the Occupy movement, that across all of these diverse issues, we're now seeing one another in a way that we hadn't before. We're starting to see the commonalities within the struggles that we all face, and we're starting to see opportunities for us to unify in a way that maybe wouldn't have occurred to us before.
And I would say that my journey as an activist kicked off with Occupy. I was working with social justice issues in dance and theater in the work that I was doing, but I wasn't politically active until an Occupy encampment in Santa Cruz, California happened to get set up exactly 2 or 3 blocks from my house. It was very hard to ignore, and so I didn't. And that kind of propelled me on the path that I am on today and in some very important ways. So I think the Occupy movement, as we're standing here looking back and looking forward at where we have to go, has played an important role in a lot of people's lives in this country. And it is like a wave on the sand, as Canadian activist Judy Rebick put it in the film Occupy Love. It has changed the landscape of the places that we're working to make change in.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our many guests, Sue Sierra Lupe, Lee Camp, and Jerry Ashton. And special thanks to David Getchy Sierra Lupe for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio for our Occupy special. It's been wonderful to reunite with my Occupy Radio co-host. And thank you to Sherry Mitchell, who is my favorite person to get on the air with week after week on Love and Revolution Radio. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd like to thank my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. If you enjoy this show, you may also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. The 5th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street was commemorated on September 17th by a gathering and story sharing at Zuccotti Park in New York City. We've discussed many subjects around the Occupy movement with our guests today, and maybe you'll think about what's happened in your life because of Occupy by the time we talk to you next week.